other yak babies. Sex, presidents, and sometimes books.
Welcome to Yak Babies, a new podcast on the internet sponsored by Good Old American Teeth. My name is Aaron, I'm here with my personal pals Dave.
Was that teeth?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, hi.
Brick.
Hello.
And calling from Old Ireland, we have two Old Irish guests, Old Irish Nico.
Hello.
And Old Irish Kathleen.
Hello.
Special guest on the podcast. Now, Old Irish Kathleen, this was your topic. Tell us what we want to discuss here. Give us the background here.
Okay, so the background is I got drunk and told Nico that you guys should do sort of a compare and contrast of an old Stephen King book and a current Stephen King book, because his older books obviously were written, you know, in the 70s, and there was a lot more like misogyny, and like women's roles especially were in some books like relegated to like wife who has no hobbies and does nothing. But that was a lot of homework. So then Nico and I talked about it, and we thought it could be like, what author have you read the longest? And how has your relationship with them changed? And it's either like, how have you changed, like going back to a book you read as a kid, or how has like the author changed? You know, like Stephen King is an easy example because he's been writing since like the 70s and he's still currently writing a ton of books.
And he has a lot of problematic shit in his early book.
And honestly, he's not great now. Like, yeah. Not when he talks, not with women. So
yeah. I'm not sure how much that's changed for Stephen King, actually.
Yeah.
I dug up Firestarter a few years ago, and there was a lot of like passive homophobia and misogynism.
Oh, really?
God, I fucked both those words up. Homophobia and misogynism.
Misogynism, yeah.
Yeah, I reread The Shining a few years back and had the same experience. It's like, ooh, not good.
Yeah. Don't and at least in The Shining, like, the woman's part at the end is crucial to getting them out. In Pet Sematary, I know Dave read this, or at least at some point you read it. Pet Sematary, the wife like hauls ass to get home because she has a feeling that something is wrong. The protagonist is about to like dig up his dead son, who's going to be a zombie killer. And she doesn't like know that, but she knows there's something wrong. So she drives all through the night, takes like four planes, and arrives like after the son is zombified, and then the son immediately kills her, and that's it.
Huh.
That's her entire role. She has no job, no hobbies. She doesn't even get to like go out drinking with him because they don't have a babysitter. Like, it's just, what is her part? Like, what is the entire 30 pages where she's running home?
She like jerks her, off her a dude in a bathtub. That's what I remember. That was her.
She does
role.
Give
that
him
was
a
her
handy.
Main role for me when I was 14.
And the hand job comes, so he like has a traumatic experience at work where a patient dies like dramatically in front of him, and to make him feel better when he gets home, she gives him a handy in a bathtub, which I was just like, is that what you do when someone I don't know. Just felt
classic
weird.
Bump and dump scenario.
That's a hard, like, I remember when I started reading it again a couple years ago, I remember noticing, one, that it was a lot better than I remembered it from a just craft standpoint. And two, that it didn't have that, like, there's a lot of homophobic stuff in that book, but it seemed like the narrator isn't doing it passively. Instead, it was like a purposeful thing that characters were doing played into this feeling of a pervasive evil that's kind of overtaken a town. But at the same time, there's a preteen gangbang. Right. So we had, this might have been a page count topic. We talked a while ago about, I don't know if it was Stephen King or a different author, going back and like reissuing his books with some of those mm-hmm. things corrected. And what,
it definitely wasn't Stephen King.
Amended.
No, because he stands by the gangbang.
I don't know how I...
he like had to he came out when those movies came out and was like,
so like I also this is gonna sound bad, but I think that scene belongs in that. It's gross, but it's not like, I think it makes sense for what it is. It's presented in a gross way, but I think the like from a plot standpoint it makes sense in a really kind of, again, playing into just like how fucking horrible shit it, you watch the movies and it's scary, but also like charming, wholesome Steven Spielberg-y 80s childhood, and like that book is actual just fucking trauma leaking out everywhere. So it fits, even though the way it's presented is definitely prurient.
It's not like gratuitous either, that sex scene, you know. She kind of like takes them all in a loving embrace. Like, there's, it's not like a gratuitous sex scene where other. You know, she's like...
Yeah, it's not like a porno.
You know, scene. There's no like threesome, I don't think. It's just like, okay, she's like hugging them and then they all have sex.
Yeah, which is, I mean, yeah. But that's also like,
you
pretty...
know, those hug sex scenarios we've all been part of.
It's like when you think, and it's like, there's a reason that they could never show that in the movie interpretations, because in reality, that's super fucking weird for an adult to put into a book.
Sure.
Right.
So my answer to this is probably Neal Stephenson. And I mean, I have vague memories of reading Snow Crash in the 90s and, you know, thinking it was super cool. But now thinking back on it, like one of the main characters is a 15-year-old girl who like moves to Alaska and like fucks her way into society. And it's like, you know, is constantly using her sexual. It's like when I'm no longer 15, that doesn't seem nearly as cool for him to put into the book.
Yeah, especially if it's not two 15-year-olds having sex. Like, that makes sense to me. But then in that book, it's like a 30-year-old man having sex with her.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like asking Aaron which Jennifer Connelly movies are still appropriate to jack off to and which ones aren't.
Rocketeer is.
That was so much tamer than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, me too. I was bracing for something a lot worse.
I think I have to say Ian McEwan, but my actual answer for like the author that I read over the most like periods of my life is probably Vonnegut, because I started reading Vonnegut when I was maybe 13 or 14 and then kept reading him through late teens and then early 20s in college and then late 20s. And then I last read Vonnegut like a year ago, and that's probably it. But he didn't change much because he was, all those books were done before I was born. So
I think if I had interpreted it differently, that would be my answer too. But I approached it as somebody who's still living and who still will continue, in theory, to put out work. And the answer I landed on is Saunders. I think the first story of Saunders I read was The Barber's Unhappiness, maybe not quite 20 years ago, from Pastoralia, the same collection in which appears Sea Oak, which we all just did a roundtable of. And that story grabbed me hard, and so I read that collection. And then I went back and read Civil War Land, which I think came out sometime in the mid-90s. And since then have kept up with anything that he publishes, at least fiction-wise. I haven't read all of his nonfiction, but fiction for sure. All of his four collections, I think now in a novel, I've returned to them all again and again.
Yeah.
And I think we'll continue to.
I think there's big changes there. How would you describe the shift?
I was just going to say, I think Saunders is an interesting example too, because he was relatively old when he first started writing, like, right? Like, wasn't he 40 or almost 40?
I think, yeah, late 30s, little early 40s, something like that. Yeah.
It seems to me to be kind of like Tennessee Williams said once, that he wrote under a different name until he was good, and then he burned everything that he wrote and started over with a new name.
Interesting.
So he doesn't really have those embarrassing, like Stephen King has some embarrassing shit. Neal Stephenson has some embarrassing shit. Like his first few books, I think he was in his 20s. Like they're weird. They're fucking really weird. And then I think also Michael Chabon would be one for me. And he started publishing books when he was in his 20s. There's also a phenomenon with those kind of writers where they get into the, if they get success early and they're like really popular, they get into a kind of a smell your own shit phase in their like middle age, where they start to think that they're bad ideas. Where they start to think that they're bad ideas or
Ian
good
McEwen.
Ideas, and they don't dig down anymore. And like the last few Chabon books have been extremely mediocre, because it just seems like it's like he's like, oh, I'm interested in midwives now. I'm gonna write a book about midwives. And it's like, why? Like, you don't like, what the fuck? and Neal Stephenson, even Ian McEwan, like it's these kind of half baked ideas. But I think Saunders, like Blinking in the Bardo, when I started reading that, he talked about how he's been thinking about that idea for 20 years. It's like, okay, this is not just, you know, a thing that came to him and he turned into a book in a year. It's like a project that he's been working on and honing for years, if not decades.
It feels a little cynical, but I think the difference, like McEwan and Chabon kind of feel like their career is writing and they need another book. And he's probably had a fucking midwife to deliver a child. He's like, I'm gonna write a book about this. I don't know, right? Or someone in his life did, and he's like, hey, this is my in. Whereas even though I don't love Stephen King, I get the very real sense from that dude that he really likes to write.
Mm, yeah.
And he really cares about his books, and he right. wants to make good books. And I know that's true with George Saunders, right? So I think there's a difference there of, you know, not to call Stephen King an artist, but like from that angle, I think that's a very real difference. I don't get any indication from the last 4 Ian McEwan books right. that he really gives a fuck.
That's right. A shame.
Gambling right. He's does. Just like, all right, either like I said, on, like we said on the nutshell, like, yeah, he's got gambling debts and like someone is just making him work out of his fucking stupid drunk ideas notebook, or he just is just like, fuck it, you know? And he's so full of himself that he just knows that his books are going to sell enough to idiots like me. I don't know, but it seems like there's a real difference in care.
I mean, Philip Roth had that phase at the end of his career too, where he started writing shorter novels. They came out pretty quickly, like every year or so another one came out, and they were varying quality, but I think they were higher quality than the Ian McEwan books, but still sort of like, it seemed like he was like, well, I got a couple ideas right. kind of floating around. I don't have a ton of time to work through this for like 10 years and put a novel out, so I'm just gonna go and crank it out, see what happens. And I mean, he was at that point a gift enough writer that he just like crank out a decent novella, and you know, wouldn't exactly make a splash, but it was still generally worth reading.
Yeah.
My answer to this question is a bit different because it's comics based. Because I was thinking about the writers I've read consistently for my entire life is comic writers. Like Mark Waid, I've read since I was pretty young until, I mean, he's still publishing today. Whereas most writers who are still alive, I either came to them pretty late, like their recent editions, or I never went back to them from when I was a kid. So I would say, like, yeah, Mark Waid, people like Grant Morrison, Peter David, Dan Jurgens, all comic writers who I like and who are still publishing, and their works are vastly different right now. It's a crazy learning curve. And Mark Waid's a really gifted writer. He was a contributing or associate editor on Watchmen before he even started writing. So he's like got a real storied career, and his books now are different. Maybe not as good potentially, but his early stuff was...
What else has he written?
Everything. Flash, Captain America, Legion of Superheroes.
Okay. Okay.
He wrote that. I don't know if you read Irredeemable, Nico. I think maybe you did, or at some point. I think I talked about it on the podcast, and for sure
yeah.
on Chamber 4. I think maybe you read a couple issues of it, which is like a Superman kind of gone bad character. Really right, great.
Yeah.
But they're the things that we're talking about with Stephen King, like the approaches to female characters and just kind of the sort of like general sense of, are other people allowed to have voices in these stories besides white men? Comics are horrible for that, especially like early 90s, even like mid 90s comics, they're rough. Like the whole concept of refrigerating came as like a trope or a fiction trope came from DC Comics when Green Lantern's girlfriend was killed and stuffed into a refrigerator, and her, like, she was in the comic for like 3 or 4 issues, and her role is to be like hot and fun, and then she got murdered, and to give him like motivation to want to kill a bad guy.
Motivation, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and like a whole sort of like critical school of thought came out of that moment, right? It's like thinking about like, what do we do, these characters in comics who are like the girlfriends of the heroes, and like, why are, you know, they're so marginalized? It's a bit better now, but still not a ton better. There's really pretty rough out there for non-white male characters in comics, especially superhero comics.
Right. It seems like maybe it's just like there's more non-white male writers
these days. For sure. I mean, in the past year, even both Marvel and DC have been trying to, it seems, bring on more writers who are people of color and sort of different gender orientations and so forth, which is all good, obviously, but it's now as opposed to 25 years ago. It's been a long, slow process of, actually not slow, it's been a long and then a sudden uptick, because all of a sudden people were like aware there was a problem here. For the vast majority of time, it's been like, well.
How much do you think is just Comicsgate fucking failing and having the exact opposite intention that they wanted to
do? Yeah, I don't know. I want to attribute it more to the voices of people of color who wanted to be represented and sort of arguing that we should have a role in this versus a rejection of them.
Right, but they've been they've been arguing that for a long time, and they weren't being heard. All of a sudden, the publishers started listening, and I wonder how much of it was just like all those assholes trying to get white power, and instead they went.
Yeah, that's a good point. And probably also just like a general possibility for greater degrees of shame that people are feeling now for whatever reason versus in the past.
I think people also, I'm assuming, in the publishing industry see it as a way to make money because readers are looking for BIPOC and the non-white male voice more than I think they were.
Yeah, well, I think, or they're just realizing that, you know, non-white people also have money and they'll, you know... It's like, if you, depending on how cynical you want to be.
Right.
Like, Black Panther, I feel like, was a watershed moment when it was like, oh, a all-black, like, movie can actually, an all-black superhero movie can have a huge box office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not just, like, a tokenizing, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we have a black superhero now, too. It's like, no, it's like a, literally celebrates, like.
Yeah, that movie was awesome.
Like, black culture and or whatever. Yeah, there's also, I think, a social media thing about it, too, right? Those complaints, or not complaints, but those voices are more visible and more accessible because they're on Twitter or Facebook or wherever now, whereas in the past, it, you know, just wasn't as, it wasn't publicized because who's publishing it? No one, really. Maybe critical content in like a scholarly journal or something like that. That's about it. Whereas now you can see that stuff when you're reading your newspaper mm-hmm. in the morning. So that probably affects some yeah. change as well. To go back to the point about changing stuff or like republishing Stephen King's works with those things taken out, I think it's a bad idea. It lets the author get away with stuff, mm-hmm. right? Like
yeah.
It's like, remember how they re-edited E.T. when they released it to change the guns in the agents' hands to cell phones? Because Steven Spielberg was worried about like it being controversial to have guns yeah. in the movie. Because it's a kids movie.
Yikes.
And I was like, yeah. no.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that takes like a lot of the.
That's what the movie was.
Threat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that's the difference in terms of like content, I guess, but also just like that's what the movie was. That's how it came out. That's what was going on at the time. So we should, if we don't want to have guns in kids' movies now, we should think about why we right. did in the past, right? And same thing with Stephen King. He wrote the scenes, right? He wrote the characters that way. It's weird to then be like, oh, I wouldn't have done yeah. it now if I could change that. It's like, well, you can't because time goes forward, not backwards.
No, that's a put a preface in your book situation.
If that.
Yeah, he does have yeah. a preface in Pet Sematary, but it's more about like, this is a story I wrote when I lived basically on a street like this, and I was worried my kids would get hit by a car. And so to me, this is the scariest story ever. And I just wish he added two more lines. I realize now that women's underwear aren't made of netting. And like some of the lines, I was like, what? Why would she open the door in a net bra? And what is a net bra? But like,
I realize now that women have more than one hole.
Yeah, I realize now that, you know, the wife's role is sort of relegated to stay-at-home mom. Yeah. He could have said something else other than just, like, it was really scary to me. I yeah. thought.
The problem, I think, with Stephen King, like, Brooke, you were saying, that he cares more. I think that he still suffers from that popular author syndrome where, like, there's clearly nobody who's going to stand up to him and say, like,
I know.
All right, this is a bad idea for a book. And that kind of bleeds into everything. So instead of like his old books being edited, like I tried to read The Stand a few years ago and he had added 500 pages to it. And it was like, it was
back to
unbelievable.
It. And it they was. They had been taken right. out in an edition and then he added them back.
They had been taken out for a reason. They had been edited out because they were not good. And he added them back. And it was just like, okay, so, I mean, publishers are just like, going to cash his check and not really hold his feet to the fire in the same way that they would even Stephen King as a younger writer. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's like he weird. Even said he published Pet Sematary because he had to like finish a deal with the publisher and he needed to get another book out.
Right. Yeah.
And I have a feeling the ending, the wife not being useful at the ending has a lot to do with the wife at the ending of The Shining being the one who gets the kids out. You know, so they probably was like, can't do that twice in like 3 years, but I don't know. Why'd she drive home then?
Yeah, there are different ways to
just leave her with their brother.
Agency and characters versus just either say that they are don't or are murdered and drive for the privilege of being murdered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to be one more dead person. Yeah. I did love the ending of the book. That part was scary.
Yeah. Do you stand by Dave's comment that it was the scariest book you ever read?
I don't really think I've ever been super scared by a book. I'm really easy to scare on TV or by movies, but with books, like I can read them in the dark in the middle of the night and it doesn't faze me and I don't know why.
Because you can close it.
But I did think it had a scary ending because it wasn't like a happy ending.
Right.
It's like a dark, twisty ending.
I call this whole phenomenon Neil Gaiman disease, because Neil Gaiman is a really bad example, I think, of this too, where he for sure got a sense of his own thing, even to the point yeah. of like marrying a fan. Like he married Amanda Palmer, and it was clearly just like she was like Red Salmon when she was in high school and like thought it was cool, was a goth, and he was like, oh yeah, I should definitely just be marrying people who love me in that sense. And like nothing is ever, he can do whatever he wants to basically, and what he does is kind of the same thing over and over again, it seems like. And he just like, he's got his yeah. character as like, I'm Neil Gaiman, the kind of gothy, kind of weirdo guy who talks about storytelling.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
I write fables.
Yeah, right. Modern mythology. I was like, no thanks.
Yeah, he seems like a super weird guy. It is also interesting just seeing, like, because I mean, maybe this is a bit more public and a bit less like PR managed than like a movie star, but more public than like executive or something. But it seems like, you know, when these people kind of succeed at everything, then it's like when the only person they have to account to is themselves, then it's like you can either become Neal Stephenson or you can become George Saunders. And George Saunders seems like he's still like holding his own feet to the fire, even if like his editor won't. A lot of these guys just don't. They just indulge themselves instead.
Yeah, it's easy to buy your own hype and be like, I am a good writer. And then just like do like whatever I do is going to be cool. And it's like, no, still got to.
Bet Neal Stephenson has a lot more money than George Saunders.
Probably.
Well, I mean, George Saunders.
A little bit of genius grant, yeah, it's true.
Genius grant, that gives him a little bit of a bump.
But does he have that sweet, sweet Dresden Dolls money?
That'd be a future game we should do, is guess who is the
author draft highest. 3.
Yeah, who's the highest income, whatever.
Who's the highest
net worth? Yeah, for.
Wasn't that one of the categories on the author
was it?
Draft?
Oh, it was. Yeah. We'll do like a straight-up quiz about it. They pick the author who has the highest net worth.
Just two? Oh, yeah.
We I mean, we need authors. Another. We Which need another author. Whenever we're allowed to come in person again, you guys are going to need like a week for the amount of shit we backed up.
Yeah,
so.
We got, there's a lot of shit coming for sure. It's going to be good.
Let's actually rent a fucking cabin in the woods.
Well, listeners, tell us who in your reading world has Neil Gaiman disease. Who is high on their own farts, or who you've been reading for the longest time, sort of like have felt a changing sort of sense of their role in your reading or just their creative experience. On Twitter, of course, YakBabies, and email us at yakbabiespodcast@gmail.com with all those thoughts and ideas. Also, go to patreon.com/yakbabies and access our bonus podcast for $1 a month. You can get all of our fun antics there. It's a good time. Recently, big deal, the first annual Yakkies, and yes, annual implies it will happen again next year. This is our award ceremony for ourselves. It's really funny, it's really good and really long. It's worth it. That's worth $1 alone, plus you get access to all other shit on top of that too, so it's definitely worth it. And our merch is out there. At some point we'll have a link to it. We don't have it yet, but you can find it on Twitter just by kind of scrolling through our posts, and there's some stuff in there as well. Until then, Yak Babies yakking off.
The Yak Babies would like to thank all the loyal listeners, and especially their patrons, both past and present, including Michael, Bonnie, Sebastian, David, Roger, Kathleen, Bailey, Andrew, and William Howard Taft.